trying to find me. I'm standing in the middle of life with my pants behind me. I got a smile for everyone I meet. As long as you don't tie dragging my bay or dropping a bomb on my street. Come on, baby. Oh, get in the road. Oh, come on now. In the middle of the road, yeah. Of the road, you see the darndest things, like fat guys driving round in jeeps through the city, wearing big diamond rings and silk suits, past corrugated tin shacks full of cancer. Man, I don't mean a Hampstead nursery. When you own a big chunk of the bloody third world, the babies just come with the scenery. Now, come on, baby, get in the road. Oh, come on now. I can't get from the cab to the curb without some little jerk on my back. Don't harass me, can't you tell? I'm going home, I'm tired as hell. I'm not the cat I used to be, I got a kid, I'm 33, baby. Get in the road. Come on now. In the middle of the road.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. We start out with How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Andrew Basevich is an author and retired Army officer. Andrew talks about the issues facing the United States Armed Forces and traces them back to the war in Vietnam. And then after that, UN Climate Change Reports as Haiku. Reports of the United Nations Panel on Climate Change are critically important but notoriously dense. IPCC scientist Gregory Johnson tells Steve Curwood about his personal project to write haiku poetry to make the reports more understandable.
Andrew Basevich, your new book, Breach of Trust, talks in the beginning some about Vietnam. How much did your time in Vietnam impact what you think today?
Very substantially, although not because my time in Vietnam was toward the end of the war, summer of 70 to summer of 71. And the experience stuck with me less because of anything I experienced as a combat platoon leader, but from what I saw in terms of the decay and deterioration of the army in which I was serving. And I think that gave me, among other things, an appreciation of the terrible effects of protracted war.
What was your career like? How long were you in the Army?
23 years. I graduated from the Military Academy in 1969 and served until 1992. There was that year in Vietnam early on. But for the most part, my experiences were those of a serving officer in the latter part of the Cold War. We thought that we existed to be prepared to fight World War III and that our readiness to do that would prevent World War III from happening. So I spent 7 years in Germany and most of the rest of the time in stateside units that would have deployed to Germany in the event of a crisis.
Am I right, 23 years in the service and finished as a lieutenant colonel?
No, colonel.
Full colonel?
Yeah.
Why did you, in the first place, go to West Point? What was the drive for you, and where were you raised?
Well, I was raised in the Midwest. I was born in Illinois and grew up in Indiana. Both my parents were World War II veterans. This is basically the 50s, a time, I think, when patriotism was a very common value, and patriotism equated to seeing military service as not simply honorable, but almost a part of what it meant to be a citizen. So I grew up in that kind of an environment. When it came time to go to college, I had choices. And I think, I went to West Point not because I thought I was going to be a career officer, but because I was attracted to what they had to offer, and I thought I'd save my parents a bunch of money by being able to pay for my own education.
And they not only paid for your education, but they paid you to go there, I assume. Is it the same way as it is now?
Yeah. You get it equates to a stipend, but it's spending money and more than spending money, yes.
Where did you grow up, in Illinois and in Indiana?
Well, I was born in Normal, Illinois, spent a little time in Chicago when my dad was in medical school. And then when my dad graduated from medical school, he served in the Army for a year as an intern in Hawaii. And when we returned from Hawaii in 1954, we returned to where he grew up in the northwest corner of Indiana, around East Chicago and Hammond.
Your years, total years, from the freshman year at the West Point to the time you got out of the service, what were those years?
1965. I became a cadet in the summer when we were first ratcheting up the U.S. combat role in Vietnam. 1965 until the summer of 1992. That's when I left the Army.
So go back to the Vietnam experience. What did you think of the Vietnam War going in? And you went in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And then what did you think of it after you spent a year there?
Well, I think to answer the question, I have to put it in a little bit broader context and put it in the context of the 1960s. So I just mentioned that my classmates and I showed up at West Point in the summer of 65. And in a sense, we missed the 1960s. We lived a relatively insulated and isolated existence at the Military Academy at the time, while outside the gates of the Military Academy, in many respects, the country was coming apart. Coming apart because of the unpopularity of the Vietnam War, also coming apart, though, because of assassinations, of racial unrest, emergence of a counterculture. So we were aware of the fact that all of this was going on outside the gates, but we were relatively untouched by all of that. In that sense, being a cadet at West Point in the latter part of the 1960s was kind of a strange experience. Now, certainly the thing that interested us most as cadets was the war. I vividly remember that at dinner, we all cadets eat together in a very large dining hall. At dinner, when they made the nightly announcements, they would announce the members of the previous class or the previous two classes who'd just been killed. So there was this constant reminder to us that we were entering an army that was at war, and Vietnam was, given the fact that it was a protracted war, was the experience that awaited us. What also became apparent as we were there is that the war was not going well. It was not simply that it was unpopular at home, but it was being mismanaged in the field and mismanaged from Washington. Now, I wouldn't say as a 19-year-old I would have been able to articulate the ways in which it was being mismanaged, but obviously this was not going to turn out to be World War II and end with a surrender ceremony on a battleship. The Tet Offensive, early 1968, happens in our junior year, and in many respects, the Tet Offensive is the turning point in terms of the American experience in Vietnam. It's at that point when even the Johnson administration acknowledges that we're no longer fighting to win. What we're fighting for is not clear, but we're not fighting to win.
Axis Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
My fellow Americans, it's me, Debbie, again. Time to have an important conversation with my Secretary of Offense. Y'all know him as Mr. Donald Rumpusfeld. Whoa. Don, you're looking kind of tense. You think maybe you ought to switch over that decapitated coffee?
Mr. President, I'm concerned about the situation in Iran. It seems clear at this point that they're working to achieve nuclear fission.
I love fission. I wonder what kind of bait they use.
So nuclear fission, as in making weapons of mass destruction.
You're not going to get me on that one again. You know what they say, fool me once. Shame on you. Fool me twice. You fooled me two times.
Mr. President, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, no offense intended.
None comprehended. By the way, have you seen Condoleezza Rice around? I've been meaning to talk to her ever since she got back from her visit to the People's Republic of China. Here, tell you what, let me call her on my SpongeBob walkie-talkie here. Condi Kane, can you come out here, please? Oh, there you are.
Yes, Mr. President, I'm back. Although I did wonder why you sent me to China, of all places.
I just thought it'd be funny to send Rice to China. Irony.
Mr. President, please, sir, we need to discuss the nuclear situation in the Middle East.
Don, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Bomb, 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 bomb Iran.
Bomb, 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 bomb Iran.
Let's bomb Iran. Bomb, 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 bomb Iran. Now that's a plan.
We'll put their Ayatollah in a spider hole in Iran.
Bomb, 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 bomb Iran.
Nukes we have vowed will not be allowed. Tehran, you keep on messing. You can see a mushroom cloud in Iran.
Please understand.
It's not assassination, just premature cremation in Iran.
Bomb, 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 Iran.
There's one thing more that we can't ignore. We haven't got the troops to go and fight another war.
Here's a plan to invade Iran.
We haven't the resources.
How about if we outsource it?
That's a plan.
Bomb, 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 kaboom!
And now, back to How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country with Andrew Basevit.
So by the time my class graduates and we deploy, most of us in spring, summer of 1970, we deploy to a war that we know will not be won. We deploy to a war that we really have no intention of winning any longer. And it turns out that we deploy to an army in Vietnam that is racked with racial tension, drug problems, disciplinary deterioration, and that makes it a difficult experience. So what did I think at the time? Well, at the time, I think I was probably confused and in some senses didn't want to think too deeply about the war, its origins, its conduct, and its prospects. Because to think too deeply about those questions would be to confront some difficult matters. So it was a little bit easier, I think, to try to do your job. Try to be a good soldier. And don't consider the larger implications of the entire Vietnam experience. I don't know if that's the way my classmates handled it, but that's the way I handled it. So I tried to do my best during my year, come home in one piece, and then go on with my life.
When you went to Vietnam, second or first lieutenant?
I had just become a first lieutenant.
What part of Vietnam were you stationed in, and what was your job?
Well, one of the things that was going on, the war was drawing down, and so President Nixon, he was the president by the time I got there, would periodically go on TV and make an announcement that another 40,000, 60,000 U.S. forces were going to come home. The effect of that was that units were closing down in Vietnam. And the effect of that on the individual was you might be assigned to this unit for your first 6 months, and then when that unit stood down, you'd go to another unit for the next 6 months. That's what happened to me. So I served in the 2nd Squadron, 1st Cavalry, in a little town called Song Mao, not too far from the coast, for roughly the first 3 months. And then I was transferred to 1st Squadron, 10th Cavalry, which was in the Central Highlands, centered on a town of An K. And the 1st Squadron and 10th Cavalry's mission was to secure a highway, QL-19, that ran from the city of Quinyan on the coast through the Central Highlands to Pleiku and Kon Tum. So our job was to keep that highway open. I was a platoon leader in Song Mao. Then I was a platoon leader in An K, and in the latter part of my tour, I was an operations officer in the squadron headquarters.
I'm going to come right back to this, but from 1990 until 2013, what kind of work have you been in?
From 1992, when I got out of the Army, to the present, I guess I've been an academic and a writer. I spent 6 years here in Washington. At the School of Advanced International Studies. It was kind of my academic apprenticeship. I was running a little research institute and doing some teaching at SAIS. Very grateful for that opportunity. And then in 1998, Boston University invited me to join the faculty. So I've been at Boston University since 1998, and that really has been a life-transforming opportunity for me. It's a wonderful place.
You describe yourself in a conversation you had at Boston University in 2010 as a conservative Catholic. Is that still the way you feel?
Yeah, I think that, a lot of people in conversation with me work on the assumption that since I went to West Point and was a soldier, those must be sort of the formative experiences in my life. And they were important experiences. But I think in many respects, what's more important is I was born and raised in the Midwest, in the so-called heartland. I was raised in a seriously Catholic household, and I remain a Catholic. That's an important thing to me. And I am a conservative, but I'm not a conservative in the sense that people who are adherents to the Republican Party claim to be conservatives. I personally think that that what passes for conservatism in this country is anything but conservative. So I would have a somewhat different definition of what it means to be conservative than I think most people, the notions that come to people's mind when they hear that word spoken.
Further define what you mean by conservative.
Well, I think first of all, begin with the notion that conservatives value our inheritance, and they wish to maintain, to preserve, to conserve that inheritance. The inheritance is intellectual, the inheritance is cultural, it's social, and it's material, the world. So to me, a conservative ought to be an environmentalist, among other things. I mean, in generally speaking, in our politics, environmentalism is kind of seen to be something that people on the left adhere to and that people on the right scoff at. I think that's utterly wrong. Conservatives should be tree huggers, to put it that way. In terms of social values, I'm a traditionalist, and I understand that there are very powerful cultural forces in our country that are dismissive of our the social structures that we have received from past generations. Frankly, those forces are so powerful that there's no turning them back. It's foolish to think that. To take gay rights as an example, it's foolish to think that one is going to restore traditional norms in that regard. That said, I think that we are too quick to overthrow these received norms and are not sufficiently aware of what some of the downsides are going to be. I think a conservative in the realm of foreign policy ought to be a realist. Ought to bridle at the notion that there is some great American mission whereby we're going to redeem or transform the world. I think a conservative should be exceedingly wary of war and also somewhat skeptical of military institutions. Wary of war because war is, at the end of the day, uncontrollable. And there may be times when you need to fight. But the notion that you should see war as a desirable instrument of policy, that's not a conservative perspective from my point of view. And we should, although we certainly should respect soldiers, conservatives should be wary of military institutions because conservatives generally ought to be concerned about any large conglomeration of power. Conservatives should favor the distribution of power rather than the concentration of power. And the greatest concentration of power in our country in our time is a concentration of power around the military. And therefore, instead of conservatives throwing money at the Pentagon, which they tend to favor doing, conservatives should be those at the forefront of watching the Pentagon. Not because we hate soldiers. On the contrary. But because, as the founders of this republic correctly identified, the concentration of military power can constitute a threat to liberty.
In the back of your book, it talks about the American Empire Project. And it writes of some of the other people that are writing for that project, Noam Chomsky, Chalmers Johnson, who is deceased, yourself, James Carroll, Michael Clare, and others, and most of those people would not be categorized as conservative. Why? Let me just ask you this. Why would you be a part of that group, and what is the American Empire Project?
Well, it's not my project, but it's a series of books. I'm happy to be part of it. I'm thrilled to be part of it. The American Empire Project is a series of books published by Metropolitan Books. That's my publisher. The series conceived of by two guys, one of whom is named Tom Engelhart. And Tom is my editor, and he's also my friend. And Tom is emphatically a person of the left in every aspect of his politics. Why am I there and still claiming to be a conservative? I think the answer is, in a sense, the answer I gave before is I think there are conservatives and principled people on the left can make common cause and should make common cause in arguing for greater restraint in the way we think about and employ our military. So Tom and I don't necessarily agree on, I suppose, abortion. But we do agree that this excessively militarized approach to foreign policy that has evolved over the last 60 or so years and kind of reached its high point after 9/11, that this is not good for the country. And therefore, one of the themes of the American Empire Project is to critique this militarism from different perspectives.
The train. places are wide open in the land of the old AEC. Why, the scenery's attractive and the air is radioactive. Oh, the Wild West is where I want to be. Mid the sagebrush and the cactus, I'll watch the fellas practice dropping bombs through the clean desert breeze. I'll have on my sombrero, and of course I'll wear a pair of Levi's over my lead BBDs. I will leave the city's rush, leave the fancy and the plush, leave the snow and leave the slush and the crowds. I will seek the desert's hush where the scenery is lush. How I long to see the mush, a room of clouds. Mid the yuccas and the thistles, I'll watch the guided missiles while the old FBI watches me. Yes, I'll soon make my appearance, soon as I can get my clearance, 'cause the Wild West is where I wanna be.
And now for something completely different.